But indeed, Ian. Yes, tonight the players of the London Symphony Orchestra make their season debut here at the Proms, along with principal conductor Valery Gergiev. On the bill, two sparkling crystalline symphonies by Prokofiev, the first and the fifth. Sitting between them, a pair of works by Henri Dutilleux, written for two of the 20th century's great performers. There's Slava's Fanfare, a tribute to his friend, the cellist Mstislav Rostropovich, and the violin concerto L'Arbre des Songes, written for Isaac Stern, and performed tonight by one of the very best of the current generation of violinists, Leonidas Kavarkos. So, why pair the music of Prokofiev and Dutilleux? I asked tonight's conductor.
I think it's a good combination. Russian-French in general, very good combination. Prokofiev, Debussy, I tried many times, very, very good. Dutilleux, Prokofiev, not that many times, but also very good. I think they are looking for colors, for melodic line, for incredible orchestral effects, rhythmic energy, with unstoppable curiosity.
Valery Gergiev. So the players of the LSO on stage now. Joining them is their leader tonight. It's Gordan Nikolic. We're kicking off this evening's concert with Prokofiev at his most blithely elegant, his most pared down. Opening this evening, the first symphony, the classical. And here's the maestro of the evening. It's Valery Gergiev, principal conductor of the LSO. Well, you could almost believe it was written in the 18th century if it weren't for those unexpected harmonic lurches off to the side that are so typical of Prokofiev, those wide, open spaces of melody that no classical composer would ever dream of. Prokofiev's first symphony, the Classical Symphony, written 1917, inspired by the composer imagining what Haydn might have sounded like had he been born in the 20th century. Performance here at the 2011 BBC Proms by the LSO, conducted by Valery Gergiev. Leading the orchestra tonight, Gordan Nikolic. So, on now to the next piece on this evening's programme. The first of those two works by Henri Dutilleux, his violin concerto, L'Arbre des Songes, The Tree of Dreams. Now, 2011 is a big year for Dutilleux's music, both here at the Proms and worldwide as celebrations of his 95th birthday continue. We've already heard his cello concerto here this season, called Tout un monde lointain, a piece written for Slava Rostropovich and performed here at the Royal Albert Hall this season, by Lynn Harrell. Well, the violin concerto that we're about to hear is just as seductive and nocturnal in mood as its cello counterpart. I caught up with this evening's soloist, the Greek violinist Leonidas Kavakos, after rehearsals to find out more. He's very fond of this piece. He's played it several times, though his initial encounter with it was in rather unusual circumstances.
The first performance was during my military service in Greece. So that was a time where there was not enough time to practice to learn it. I had managed to secure 1.5 hours of practicing every day in the camp during dinner time. And what
so
I had.
You didn't eat dinner for
No, for about a month and a half. And the room I had was a small room with a small window without light. So it was the whole kind of feeling and situation of learning such kind of piece with this kind of title. In that environment was practically for me the realization of the title of the piece, you know, The Tree of Dreams. For me, that piece was the tree that would get me out of the window of that camp, out of that camp. And when I said this to Dutilleux, he smiled and I could see he was moved by it.
Tonight's soloist Leonidas Kavakos on why the music of Henri Dutilleux is worth missing your dinner for. Well, for a composer who insists that he doesn't write program music, Dutilleux does come up with some pretty evocative titles. He's often inspired by art, by literature. In the case of this piece, L'Arbre des Songes, the violin concerto he wrote for Isaac Stern, the title is a metaphor for the organic form, the thematic development of the piece. Kavakos told me he sees it as a tree growing into life, that it starts with the base of the trunk, and as it grows upwards, it gets ever more filigree, more delicate, its branches more sinewy and complex. All in all, says Dutilleux himself, the piece grows somewhat like a tree. Constant multiplication and renewal of all of its branches is the lyrical essence here. So the players now tuned, all on stage and settled as we await the arrival of our soloist and our conductor. Here they are now, the violinist Leonidas Kavakos, followed closely by conductor Valery Gergiev for a performance of Henri Dutilleux's violin concerto, L'Arbre des Songes. L'Arbre des Singes, the violin concerto of Henri Dutilleux, performed by the LSO, conducted by Valery Gergiev, the soloist Leonidas Kavarkos. Well, I was talking to Kavarkos earlier today. The key to a successful performance, he told me, is creating exactly the right atmosphere for this piece. It needs a sense of timelessness, dreams, of memory. That, he says, and also getting the colour just right. It's a huge orchestra. Everyone here has a part to play, even if it's just at moments of punctuation. Getting the sonic quality right, he said, is absolutely essential. Well, applause now for Christine Pendril, Oboe d'Amore, brought to her feet by Valery Gergiev and given warm applause too by tonight's soloist. You may well remember he was here performing the Korngold Violin Concerto last year at prom I was at. It was a sensational prom because he's always such an impressive and assured performer. A wonderful balance with him of head and heart, whether he's playing Bach or Mozart or Mendelssohn or the 20th and 21st century repertoire that he's such a passionate champion of. It's worth saying that if you are a fan of Leonidas Kavarkos, you better get your skates on. He's actually going to be doing his major season moment is going to be the Beethoven sonatas, the complete Beethoven sonatas with Emmanuel Axe here at the Proms just recently playing Brahms. They're doing a tour together of the complete Beethoven sonatas, one of their pit stops, London's Wigmore Hall, bound to be a really hot ticket. Kavarkos also on a major tour with the Gewandhaus Orchestra and back in London later in the season for two more concerts with Gergiev. These two musicians have a wonderfully close relationship. They'll be performing concertos by Sibelius and Stravinsky. And as if that wasn't enough, he's going to be in Berlin in April, Kavarkos, giving the premiere of a brand new concerto by Osvaldo Golijov. So much to look forward to from this immensely talented performer. Well, it's time now for an interval of around 25 minutes before the second half of this evening's concert. Still to come, the most popular of all of Prokofiev's symphonies. It's one of the fruits of the composer's life spent in Soviet Russia in the 40s, his searing yet enigmatic Fifth Symphony. We'll be hearing from Valery Gergiev about what he thinks makes that piece tick. And Henri Dutilleux tips his hat to another of the key figures of Russian 20th century music, Mstislav Rostropovich. Slava's fanfare, in all its blazing glory, is here at the Proms. Before that, though, it's time for our interval feature as we turn our attention to wartime Russia. The poet and translator Sasha Dugdale unpacks the official Soviet myths that were spread during the Second World War and which at the time helped to sustain morale, but which later engendered profound mistrust.
Everything I learned, all the stories I heard as a child, it turns out none of it was true. It leaves you feeling empty inside. You want to know something was true.
In autumn 1941, the German army reached the outskirts of Moscow. It was the beginning of a long, cold winter. The city's ministries, factories, and organizations had already been evacuated east, but there were many people left, some desperately trying to evacuate themselves on foot or stow away on trains. A very stretched Home Guard was preparing to defend Moscow with whatever came to hand. Looters and squatters were breaking into empty flats. And in this atmosphere of terror and dislocation, a woman walked down a central street in Moscow. This woman had suffered Soviet persecution for years, and she had not been able to leave Moscow because she had no job. The street was deserted. Snow was falling. In all the ministry buildings, fires were burning, and the ashes of documents and papers were mixing and falling with the snow. On an instinct, she turned into a doorway, and finding it open, continued into a ministry building. A flight of stairs appeared before her. She climbed the stairs without thinking, and at the top of the stairs, she turned into one of the rooms as if guided by some supernatural force. A fire smouldered in the room. Filing cabinets lined the walls. She went over to one of them, opened a drawer at random, and took out a single file. It was her file. She opened the file, took out the contents, and threw them on the fire. The papers glowed, and then caught, and burnt brightly for a short while, before disappearing forever. She left the building noiselessly, her new life as an irreproachable Soviet citizen, beginning in the ashes and snow falling on an empty Moscow street. If we think of myth as an imaginative ordering of experience, then this story is a myth. It seems highly unlikely to be true, although, of course, many highly unlikely things do happen. But maybe it is true that in the nightmarish chaos of the days when Hitler's army stood outside Moscow, the woman's status as a persona non grata was really lost or erased, and like a phoenix from the flame, she emerged renewed as an integrated part of Soviet society. Later came the need to explain this, to arrange it into a visual transformation, and so the story metaphor emerged with its fairy tale quest to an abandoned castle and the series of inspired choices which set her free. The same story I heard on a long train journey 60 years later, told by the woman's grandson. I've begun with a personal myth because, in fact, it stands in stark contrast to the best-known myths of Soviet war history, the heroic myths which later shaped a country's understanding of the war. The Soviet Union that was invaded in 1941 was a totalitarian state, and its myths were totalitarian in nature. These myths were closely guarded and so conceived as to lift their heroes and heroines into instant immortality. There was nothing subtle about these myths. They were designed to reach enormous audiences, to inspire, move, and shame millions. One such immortal heroine whose actions have been eclipsed by mythical interpretation is Zoya Kosmodemyanskaya. She was a partisan in occupied Moscow district who went by the name of Tanya, and whose task was the burning down of houses and buildings in villages occupied by the German army in 1941. We must tread carefully here because most of what seems to be known about Zoya is not clearly factual, and accounts differ wildly. It seems that she was caught by the fascists, as the German soldiers were always called in the Soviet Union, tortured and publicly executed by hanging. Her story was picked up by the Pravda journalist Pyotr Lidov in 1941. He heard the story from a man who had witnessed the hanging and who said that the condemned woman had made speeches as she was being hanged. According to another account, she said, "You can kill me, but behind me stand 150 million. After a great degree of publicity, Zoya became the first female official Soviet war hero, and even now most former Soviet towns have a street bearing her name. The Moscow metro station, Partizanskaya, is decorated with a huge heroic statue of Zoya. A book titled A Tale of Zoya and Shura by Zoya's mother was a primary school reader in the post-war Soviet Union. Her exemplary life was given as a role model to the young. There are a number of photographs which purport to be of Zoya's execution. She was indeed a beautiful young woman, and there are dramatic scenes of her mounting the scaffold, short-haired, in a greatcoat, with a placard around her neck which reads Brandstifter or Arsonist, and further distressing photographs of her lying dead on the ground, her neck peculiarly distended, her breast bare, her face still beautiful. It is said that these photographs were taken by an occupying soldier. Zoya's story is in many respects a Soviet hagiography, the life of a modern saint. Many elements of the hagiography are not consistent. Many of the details contradict each other. Her early life under scrutiny turns out to be full of the deeds which mark the childhood of a saint. But Zoya and the other heroes of the war served a purpose in the 1940s. They were the great warriors, urging people forward against the fascist foe. It is impossible now to imagine the terror of occupation or the horror of battles and siege in wartime Russia, or the strength of the myth needed to bind nations together against a common enemy. And we should not forget that real Russian teenagers genuinely did sign up to go behind enemy lines and commit acts of sabotage, knowing that the likely outcome was torture and death. Whoever Zoya was, she represented a generation of young people who willingly faced death for the sake of their country. But the Soviet state took and shaped its heroes as the church once did. More pernicious, to my mind, is the enshrining of a woman of doubtful deed and identity in the self-image of a nation, the taking of a hagiography with little basis in proved fact, and using it to inspire a cult of self-sacrifice and virginal death which was preached to young children. Some myths seem to grow out of a pleasing confluence of circumstances, but others result from the need to explain and justify a political situation. Sometimes the organisation of a myth requires the active suppression of other people's experiences, as the next story demonstrates. Another great myth of the battle for Moscow is that of the 28 men of Panfilov's division. The 28 Panfilovtsev, as they are known in Russia, are commemorated everywhere. There is a museum to their glorious deeds, a number of vast stone-clad shrines, a list of their names in Victory Park. In the same dark period in autumn 1941, when Moscow was in imminent danger, 28 men of the division commanded by Major General Panfilov are said to have fought with their lives and destroyed 18 fascist tanks in 4 hours of terrible battle. For this act of valour, the men were posthumously named Heroes of the Soviet Union. The original story of the 28 men was reported in the Red Star newspaper in 1941. In early 1942, the same newspaper gave a list of their names, and it was on the basis of this journalism that the 28 men were given their status as heroes. For many years, there were doubtful rumours. Men whose names were on the list appeared alive and kicking in other places. In 1966, the literary journal Novy Mir published an article expressing doubts. But it was the declassification of war records at the end of the 80s which proved fatal for the myth. Here's a quote from a radio interview with a Russian historian, Andrei Martynov, broadcast on radio station Echo Moskvy in 2006, which describes the way in which the original newspaper report was written.
When this article was written, when it was brought to him, Ortenbjerg, the editor of the paper and an important propaganda man, asks how many soldiers there were. And Karatyev, the journalist, answers, about 30 to 40, but two tried to surrender and were killed by the other Red Army soldiers. To which Ortenbjerg says, so let's say 30, and we can't have two traitors, so make it one. And later, on the 28th of November 1941, the journalist Alexandra Kavitsky writes his famous article, A Testament to 28 Fallen Heroes. Interestingly, it's almost a Freudian slip. 28th of November, 28 heroes. It's in this article that we get the description of the main canons of the myth.
Later in the same interview, the historian Martynov discusses one of the named heroes, Ivan Dobrobabin. Ivan turned up later in the war and was tried for treason, as he had been living in occupied territory and apparently helping the Germans. Although again his treason is disputed, some maintain he helped partisans and warned them when traps were set against them. He was tried in a special court and allowed no defence. He received a 15-year sentence and was conveniently removed from the scene. Another of the Panfilov men who turned up alive was forced to write a statement saying he hadn't been at the battle, and a dead replacement with the same surname was found. It wasn't until the 1990s that the journalists responsible were interrogated, and according to Martynov, completely different numbers and scenarios came up. One journalist very quickly began admitting that his article was mostly founded on invention. The phrase he used is now well known. Lidov invented Zoya Kosmodemyanskaya, and I invented the 28 men of the Panfilov division. When I began thinking about this subject, I spoke to a number of my Russian friends about these and other Soviet myths. And one of my friends, now in her mid-30s, said this.
It's the most awful feeling. Everything I learned, all the stories I heard as a child, the tale of Zoya and Shura, which I cried over. It turns out none of it was true. It leaves you feeling empty inside. You want to know something was true.
I asked her how it was for an older generation who had lived their whole lives with these war myths. And here's what she replied.
For them, it's too late. They can't cope with the complete change. My mother is just numb inside. Nothing now can affect her. She believes nothing.
It's not difficult to see why others continue to believe in the existence of these heroes, despite the evidence to the contrary. It is even clear to see why people might aggressively defend such myths and accuse those who doubt them as deniers, weak liberals, or even traitors. The problem is that Russia fought a terrible war, a war in which many millions lost their lives. For many former Soviet citizens, the unravelling of the myths which were emblematic of that war begins to hint at the futility of their sacrifices and the deaths of their loved ones. The Soviet Union's psychological rehabilitation after the Great Patriotic War relied on an image of Russia as heroic saviour of Europe. And if the mythical cornerstones are removed, then what is left? What is left? What is real?
The 40s, the fated 40s, the years of war, the frontline years, the missing in action telegrams, the clanking of the military trains, the humming of the railway lines. The world was wide, cold, deep, and refugees from burnt-out towns made their trail from west to east. Look, a little railway halt. In my filthy cap I stand, the star on my forehead cut from an old tin can. Yes, this is me in the big wide world, skinny, happy, chancing all. I have my purse of tobacco, I have my mouthpiece, stem and bowl. And I'm passing the time with a girl, and limping more when she's around, and breaking my ration bread in two, there's nothing I don't understand. How strange it is, how it all came to be, war and grief, dreams and youth, and how it laid its seed in me, and only later came to life. The 40s, the fated 40s, the years of lead, grenade and gun, when war danced across Russia, and we were so very young.
David Samulov's poem is the classic Russian war poem, real experience shaped by the poetic imagination. Because, of course, it was all real. It did happen. The myth, the falsification, is a betrayal of the real. Poetry, unlike official myth, cleaves to human experience. It eschews the general for the specific. It feeds off the ordinary, the unpredictable, the real. When Martynov is asked in the same radio interview whether the explosion of the myth of the 28 Panfilov men left nothing, no act of valour, he answered with another tale. A tale of far greater numbers, far fewer tanks, but a tale which seems far more likely. On the 16th of November, 1941, in the same place where the 28 Panfilov men were supposed to have died their glorious death, around 130 men, 30 of whom had escaped death in an earlier rout, fought off 10 or 12 German tanks with only 11 anti-tank guns, two 76mm guns, some elderly First World War guns, and some French cannons from a museum. They destroyed five or six of the tanks and beat back the rest. It appears that 100 men died. Those who were wounded died because it was too cold to survive on the ground. The real story, however, was buried because, in fact, despite their courage, the Russian line was broken, and that close to Moscow, a broken front line would have meant a court-martial. Some of the men killed might possibly have participated in the victory parade 9 days earlier. In 1941, on the 7th of November, when the German army was only scores of kilometres from Moscow, a victory parade took place on Red Square to commemorate the revolution, as it had done every year. Utmost secrecy surrounded the parade to protect it from attack, And in fact, it is said some of the participants knew nothing about it until they found themselves marching over Red Square. It was a freezing day. Snow had fallen. The conductor on the bandstand froze to the spot and had to be pulled free by his musicians. The soldiers were taken from the front line, and as soon as the parade was over, they were returned to the front line for active duty. But the parade was a massive propaganda coup for Stalin, who made one of his few speeches to the nation and showed himself to be in Moscow with his people and not cowering behind the Urals, as German propaganda had insisted. Hitler, it was said, had planned a German victory parade on that very day in Red Square and was, it is said, enraged by the Soviet march. Victory Day in 1941, the myth of might, sustained the Soviet morale through its first appalling winter of war. The footage of the parade is touching. The soldiers are dressed in thick, shapeless coats. They look scruffy and deadbeat and bewildered. They have ordinary faces. They stand listening to Stalin expressionless, and the snow falls around them. I look at them and see them marching back to the front line just an hour or so later, and the odds are so stacked against them. When I watch this footage, it is the men of the First World War in their trenches who come to mind. The Great Patriotic War is to Russia what the First World War is here. The slaughter of millions, the endless roll call of the dead. Their Moscow, Kursk, Smolensk, Stalingrad are our Passchendaele, Ypres, Somme. The tomb of the unknown soldier in every town is the Russian version of the French graveyard, where many thousands of names are marked the missing of the Somme. The only difference is that the slaughter of young men on the Somme has often been portrayed as pointless loss. In Russia, the victory has always justified the destruction of a generation. Just as the First World War was the war of pity and poetry here, so the Second World War was the war of poetry in Russia. And just as we read Wilfred Owen for the poetic shaping of real experience, so Russian poetry shapes an alternative myth of war. In Russia, poetry has the final, convincing victory over false myth. It feels appropriate to end with a real myth about real heroes, the poem Before the Attack by Semyon Gudzenko.
Men sing when they go to their death. Perhaps, though, they weep until that, for the very worst hour of battle is the hour before the attack. The white snow is gashed by shells, and shells have dusted it with black. An explosion, and a friend is gone, so death has passed behind my back. And now my turn has come, I know. Another man will hunt me down. The sky longs for the signal's arc. The men long, too, on the frozen ground. It feels to me I am a magnet. I draw the shells through the sky. An explosion, our lieutenant gasps, and death again has passed me by. But we can wait no longer now. Hatred, hardened to rock, leads us out and over trenches, jabs and rips another's neck. The battle's done. And then we necked the icy vodka down. I ran my knife behind my nails to clean out blood that was not mine.
Before the Attack by Semyon Gudzenko, ending that edition of 20 Minutes. It was written and presented by the poet and translator Sasha Dugdale. The readers were Elaine Claxton and Gerald McDermott. The producer was Beattie Rubens. the regular promenader's message from the arena, signalling that we are indeed here at the Royal Albert Hall. A very warm welcome if you've just joined us. From me, Susie Klein, we're live on Radio 3 for this evening's prom given by the London Symphony Orchestra under its principal conductor, Valery Gergiev. Next up, we are staying in wartime Russia and more music by Prokofiev. It's the Fifth Symphony, a piece that made such an impact across Russia, Europe and the United States that within months of its American premiere in 1945, a portrait of the composer was featured on no less than the cover of Time magazine. So what's the secret of the piece's appeal? I talked to Valery Gergiev earlier and I asked him just that.
It's incredible to see how Sergei Sergeyevich Prokofiev was able to move away from any political, any propaganda, any nationalistic feelings, celebrations, or even very somber, very tragic atmosphere, even at the end of the war, when so many lives were lost. He just went for a most incredible musical composition. You hear it's a war symphony, but also he was able to give us the most spectacular, powerful symphony, one of the greatest of century. And I never feel tired of this symphony. I conducted it many times, never it happened to me. You look at the end of first movement, it has sometimes several reminders of how serious is this atmosphere of the symphony, how deep and heartfelt is the feeling he has for people suffering for so long around him. But his incredible, even festive musical gifts are taken over. And at the end of this, I would call it, there was no artillery in the Second World War which altogether would match the final 2 minutes of the first movement of the symphony. That's why the human spirit is a winner, not tanks, human spirit. And in this case, Sergei Prokofiev was talking for humanity and on behalf of millions and millions of people who finally prevailed.
Valery Gergiev there on the very human triumphs of Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony, one of the great pieces of 20th century Russian music. But before we hear that this evening, music written in honour of a great Russian, the cellist Mstislav Rostropovich. It's the first performance here at the proms of Dutilleux's musical tribute to a great friend. It's called Slava's Fanfare. Now, the piece is only 4 minutes long, but listen out to see if you can spot a very famous little fragment of music. It's the famous theme from Dvorak's Cello Concerto. You'll hear it as a little musical quotation just before the end of this piece. Thank you. Members of the wind and brass sections of the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Vanyeri Gergiev, Slava's fanfare.
Thank you.
Well, the sheer drive of that music, its intense darkness and sense of menace, as well as the blistering light there at the end, is just overwhelming in live performance. You can hear it all crystal clear on the radio, but what you can't feel is the floor literally shaking at the close of Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony, a performance here at the Proms by the London Symphony Orchestra with their principal conductor, Valery Gergiev. And the LSO reminding everyone here at the Royal Albert Hall tonight just what a world-class orchestra they really are. If you want a quick snapshot of their versatility, in the last few weeks alone, they've been resident at the Aix-en-Provence Festival, they've cut a new album of contemporary music at Abbey Road, and they've played on the latest George Clooney soundtrack. So just a small picture of what they've been up to. Worth saying, this is the first of two concerts that the LSO is giving here at the Proms this season. They are back on Sunday, the 4th of September, Beethoven's Missa Solemnis. Colin Davis, the LSO president, will be conducting with a great lineup of soloists. That concert, as all of the Proms, live here on BBC Radio 3. Meanwhile, tomorrow evening, here at the Royal Albert Hall, the always brilliant Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra is here, joined by Colin Davis, conducting a programme including Stravinsky's Symphony in Three Movements, Ravel's Scheherazade with the mezzo Susan Graham, and Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. Join us for that live from 7, or you can check in later tomorrow evening for One Man and a Piano. Marc-André Amelin plays Late Night List tomorrow from 10. Meanwhile, it's been a real pleasure to have had your company here this evening. Time now to hand you back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House.
Susie, thank you very much. That was Susie Klein at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. And don't forget that you can hear that prom again, two ways, in fact, either by tuning into Radio 3 on Friday afternoon this week at 2:30, when it's one of our BBC proms in Afternoon on 3, or you can hear it anytime you'd like to over the next 7 days if you have access to the internet by visiting the Radio 3 website and then clicking on Listen Again. Well, stay with us here on Radio 3 for the next in our Proms season series of Librecht interviews, in-depth conversations with some of the movers and shakers in the arts world. Tonight, the world of dance and music is to the fore when Monica Mason reflects upon her career, most of which has been with the Royal Ballet in London. She's now the company's director and she's about to embark on her very last season in that role, all in the year that she celebrates her 70th birthday. She talks frankly and warmly about her work with the ballet, and you can hear that conversation tonight at 10 o'clock here on Radio 3 in just over 25 minutes' time. We'll also be reflecting some more on that movement of the early 20th century that was both groundbreaking and a little odd in its approach, the music appreciation movement. It's the subject of our essays this week, presented by the historian Richard Witts. His subject tonight is Walford Davies, who was one of the pioneers of schools broadcasting in this country. He brought into his team of music educators people like Imogen Holst. The Bloomsbury Group, though, rather dismissively called his team Walford's Holy Women. And you can hear why tonight at 11:15. Then Verity Sharp will be here to bring you her first selection of the week in Lake Junction. Tonight, everything from a piece by Steve Reich for string quartet and electronics to English bell ringing and some desert blues. Lake Junction, where anything can happen, is at 11 o'clock tonight here on BBC Radio 3. Thank you. That was a homage to Chopin by Franz Bendel, who was a pupil of one of the composers featured in this year's Proms, Franz Liszt. As Susie Klein was saying there, a late night full of Liszt's own piano music is tomorrow night on Radio 3, a late night prom beginning at 10 o'clock. And I've got some more piano music which was given Liszt's inimitable treatment in just a moment, one of his many transcriptions, and played by someone who will be making an appearance in a couple of weeks at the Royal Albert Hall this year. Well now, let's head first to the Midlands of England in a moment for a reflective song from Beyond the Grave by a fallen soldier, but first, a bracing walk up on Wenlock Edge.
Thank you. my friend heartily know I am thin and pined. And has he found to sleep in a better bed than mine?
Is My Team Ploughing, and before it, On Wenlock Edge. The two songs from a set of six by Vaughan Williams, his setting of words by A.E. Housman from his Shropshire Lad. Ravel played the piano part in that song in its very first performance in France and told Vaughan Williams afterwards that his lyric poems were a revelation, not just to Ravel, but to many musicians in Paris. Well, the pianist on that occasion was Anna Tilbrook. The songs were sung by James Gilchrist, and the Fitzwilliam String Quartet were in attendance throughout. It's just coming up to 10 to 10 now. Monica Mason has spent all her working life at the Royal Ballet in London. She's now 70 and about to start her final season as director of the company there. She's in conversation with Norman Lebrecht this evening, talking frankly about her experiences in various roles in the company throughout the years. That's the Lebrecht interview at 10 o'clock this evening. But let's go back to the Proms now, where Hélène Grimaud will be playing at the Royal Albert Hall in a couple of weeks' time, on the 5th of September, in fact, playing the fourth of Beethoven's piano concertos with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. Well, here she is now, playing music adapted for piano by one of the composers whose own music threads its way throughout the entire Proms season this year, not least in our late Prom tomorrow night, Franz Liszt. This is a prelude and fugue by Bach, BWV 543, originally created by him for the organ, but adapted here for the one keyboard of the piano by Liszt. Tremendous combination of Liszt and Bach. Hélène Grameau playing a transcription by Liszt of a prelude and fugue Bach wrote for organ, BWV 543. She's at the Proms playing Beethoven just over a week from now on the 5th of September, live here, of course, on Radio 3 from 7:30. And as I say, plenty of Liszt's own music tomorrow night in the hands of another French pianist, Marc-André Amelin, playing Liszt's Fantasia and Fugue on the letters B-A-C-H, as well as the second of his Legends, amongst other pieces. That's our late prom, live here on Radio 3 from 10 o'clock tomorrow night.
Original British drama on BBC Two.
Take another look at the bottom of page 8.
One document starts a dangerous game of trust.
Do you know the source?
Of course I don't know the source.
One wrong move could end everything.
This is about the survival of the department and the Prime Minister.
Page 8, written and directed by David Hare and starring Bill Nighy, Rachel Weisz and Michael Gambon. This Sunday at 9 o'clock on BBC Two.
Back here on Radio 3, it's 10 o'clock. Time for this week's Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Dame Monica Mason is the unlikeliest of heroines. A dancer at the Royal Ballet, then an administrator's assistant, she was never considered for the top job until, after a period of extraordinary turbulence, she stepped up to the bar and took control. 9 years later, a season before retirement at 70 years old. She's about to leave the company in a state of greater stability and creativity than it's been since the days of its founder, Ninette de Valois. Now, how did that happen with someone so unassuming in charge? South Africa-born, Monica Mason was brought to London at 14 and 2 years later joined the company where she'd spend the rest of her life. De Valois was dominant, Margot Fonteyn was about to meet Rudolf Nureyev, and Frederick Ashton was the master choreographer. Mason caught the eye of Kenneth Macmillan, the troubled, alternative choreographer. When she stopped dancing, she became his repetiteur, then his assistant director, a position she maintained under two successors, Anthony Dowell and Ross Stretton. Always the bridesmaid, as it were, until December 2002, when Stretton imploded and Mason was the only one who could pick up the pieces. Since then, she's appointed two major choreographers at the heart of the company and staged the first full evening ballet in a generation. Unusually for a leader in the arts, she's been unfailingly transparent, truthful and ego-free. Monica Mason, where did the dancing come from in your life? When did you feel that you wanted to be a dancer?
It was really when I saw the Sadler's Wells Theatre Ballet in Johannesburg. I was 12. The company came to Johannesburg with a wonderful repertoire of mixed bills, triple bills, as we call them. And there were works there by Cranko, Macmillan, Rodriguez. And up until that time, I hadn't seen a fully professional company. It was the first time I'd witnessed it. And somehow, of course, now the reason for going to class and taking one's these awful exams, it made sense. And also at the same time, Frank Staff, who had been a dancer in England and returned to South Africa, made a little company, just half a dozen, 10, 12 people. And I used to go along to his classes, and also he asked my mother if I could join his company. Now, we did very few performances and just around the outskirts of Johannesburg. And I mean, sometimes there was just one man and a dog in the audience. But it was my first experience of a choreographer. And he was very theatrical. And I don't think I ever had any doubts that I was going to have to do this somehow. I loved the work. I loved the challenge. I loved the music. I loved performing. I liked hearing applause. I liked pleasing somebody and having them say, tonight was much better than last night, and understanding why and what could you take from that to the next show. I don't think really at 12, 13, you don't really think about the future a great deal. It's very much the present.
And your parents?
And yes, and then my father died.
Suddenly?
Very suddenly. He died in a week.
And you were 14?
I was 13, actually. 13. And it was a terrible shock. He hadn't had a day's illness in his life. But he had cancer and he had ignored all the warning signs, and I think he suspected that something terrible was happening. And by the time he saw a specialist and was admitted to hospital, it was far too late. And I just sort of felt at the time, life's going to be completely different. Now where? Now where do we go? What do we do? And my mother was in her middle 30s, a very attractive, active person, full of life, fun, very practical, wonderful sense of humour, a really special person. She was so brave. She had to go back to work. She hadn't worked since she'd had children. And we had to sell the house and move into a little flat. And life for a year and a half was very different. And then my mother decided to come to England. My father had had a business associate who lived in London, who was mad about the theatre, loved ballet. And when he'd come to Johannesburg and stayed with us, he used to talk about performances that he'd seen. And I remember once he brought a very big coffee table book, Baronet the Ballet, and he gave it to me as a gift. And of course I'd never seen anything like it. These turned the pages and there were these giants of the dance world. And he said, oh, I've seen Robert Helpman, and of course I've seen Margot Fonteyn, and this is Michael Soames, and this is Moira Shearer. And there were all these people coming to life as he talked about the performances that he'd seen. And so when he said to my mother, you know, if you think Monica has talent, why don't you come to London and see what can happen there? And so that's what we did. And 6 months after we arrived, my mother married him. So he became my stepfather, and he was a remarkable person, taught me so much that, interestingly enough, in a way, I suppose I've used throughout my life, both my mother and my real father, but also my stepfather, were immensely practical people. The world was full of good sense and good advice and no dramas and kind of calm living and not fighting and never raised voices. And life was very, very calm. And that's the kind of world I grew up in. And I suppose I've always sought that in a way. And so some of the words and the advice that my mother gave me over the years, and my stepfather, really, they come back. I suppose we're all like that, you know. We have a little notebook full of references, don't we? And so I suppose I feel very blessed, and that I had the benefit of this very stable early life.
But quite straitened circumstances. It was a bedsit in Finsbury Park to start.
Yes, we were.
It can't have been easy after the sun-kissed life in South Africa.
I don't know how my mother did that. I mean, it was a bed and breakfast. I remember the joy of coming back from school on a sort of chilly winter evening or autumn evening, and the kettle would boil and she'd make a pot of tea and I'd talk about how the day had been. She always listened. She was the most fantastic listener. You know, and years later I thought, I don't think I ever asked her, but what did you do all day? What had she done all day? She was used to playing lots of tennis and tending a very large garden and having lots of friends, and now she was in this gloomy little place in Finsbury Park, and she never, ever seemed depressed or troubled. She was the most incredibly unselfish person, in other words.
How did you get from there to the Royal Ballet?
Well, you know, I was at the Royal Ballet School for a year, and it was towards the end of the year that I was told that I was going to join what was then the Opera Ballet. And the Opera Ballet was made up of six girls and six boys who were in their graduate year at the ballet school, and they used to appear with both the opera and the ballet companies. Now, in those days, of course, the ballet company every other year went on a five-month tour of America. So for half of the year, they wouldn't have been dancing with the ballet because the company wasn't there, but they did a lot in the operas. And so I was very much looking forward to this. And on the day that I'd been told I was going to join the opera ballet, I phoned my mother and told her that this had happened, and she was, of course, thrilled. And about an hour later, I was called into the director of the school's office. Her name was Ursula Morton, she was one of the original dancers for de Valois in the 30s. And she said, Monica, what is that blank expression on your face? And I said, well, Miss Morton, I've just been told I'm going to join the opera ballet, and I'm surrounded by people who are joining the companies. Oh, she said, just a moment, there's been a mistake. And she said, I don't quite know how this has happened, but you're joining the company at Covent Garden. And that was how I heard. So, of course, I then went immediately afterwards. My feet weren't on the ground at all. Rang my mother again and said, you'll never guess what happened. I'm going to join the company, not the opera ballet. And she actually didn't believe me. She said, I think you're having a little fantasy. And I said, no, 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 it's absolutely true. I think somebody suddenly left the company. And so at 16, I was dropped into the main company. But, you know, in no time at all, one kind of slotted in and got the hang of things. And Frederick Ashton was choreographing Ondine at the time, and it was coming up to its premiere. And obviously the person who had suddenly left made a space for me. So I became one of the Ondines. And there was this extraordinary Henze score, and dear Sir Fred scratching his head. And I could hear him saying, oh, this piece of music is impossible. What am I going to do to this? And play it again, and these pianists who played, one was a wonderful woman called Hilda Gaunt, and knew exactly what Fred needed and wanted, and she would repeatedly play these phrases of Henze for him. And we all struggled to try and get to grips with this music. And in no time at all, we had fittings, and then it was the premiere. And there was Margot starring, looking absolutely wonderful, and Michael Soames, and one was in it. Suddenly, you were in it completely. And I remember meeting Kenneth Macmillan at that point. He was remounting Danse Concertante, which he'd created on the small company, the touring company. And he also had another ballet that I appeared in and had to learn at a day's notice. So, you know, life kind of took off.
And outside of that, so on the one side you have this fantastic opening, and on the other side you're still in pretty Spartan conditions at school. One thinks, sort of imagines cold showers and pretty frugal and nasty food. And
you were taken care of, but only up to a point. You had to get on with it. You had to ask lots of questions because they didn't mollycoddle you in any way at all. My first salary was £9 a week at that time in 1958. It was Spartan living. You know, we shared costumes, we shared wigs. It was not a surprise to get into a costume that someone else had worn at the matinee, and now you were wearing it in the evening and was slightly damp from the matinee. And it wasn't your damp. Sort of unsavoury, really, and nowadays it wouldn't happen. But it was wonderful. It was the theatre. But I think the thing that astonished me was the amount of work one had to do, that it was every single day and 6 days a week. It was never too much. I mean, I could never get enough of it, really.
When did you first come to the attention of Nina de Valois, madam? When did you catch her eye, do you remember?
I don't know that I did, really. I remember that I was in one of her ballets very early on, not long after I joined the company. She used to, of course, take her rehearsals of her own work, and she was mounting The Rake's Progress, an absolute masterpiece, and I was terrified of her because she was seldom around. You could feel everybody was on their best behaviour when she appeared. And what astonished me was how nervous the staff were when she was around. You could feel that they often had to defend themselves. She didn't know anybody's name, apart from the principal dancers. And she would say, who's that girl? No, the one. And I remember her once saying, no, the big one. And I heard them say, Mason. And so I thought, big? Am I big? In what way am I big? Anyway, it was because I was taller at the time than the average dancer. And I was learning the role of the singer in the brothel scene, the ballad singer. I'd been shown how I made my entrance and we had to sort of shuffle in. I shuffled in and she immediately stopped the rehearsal and said, I mean, you don't call that an entrance, do you? Go back and do it again. But no instruction as to what you had to do. And of course, even then I thought, how am I going to do it again better if I haven't had a correction? What am I supposed to do? So shuffled off and the music of intro came and on I shuffled again. And of course, it happened about three times until the ballet mistress came round and gave me some correction and the rehearsal was able to continue. And so, of course, You know, that's terrifying when you're young. And, you know, I always thought, oh, well, she thinks I'm stupid. And then I also watched her demolish people sometimes. And, of course, then I remember the trip to Russia, 1961. We were there for 6 weeks. It was absolutely amazing. And I remember that she made speeches. My outstanding memory of her was how she was on that tour. And it was, you know, very important, this tour. She never stumbled over her speeches. She never spoke for very long. She never had any notes. And she never repeated herself. I just remember thinking, she is brilliant.
You became quite close to her later on.
Yes, I did.
Late in life.
She was wonderful later on, and I was able to be very open with her, and I discovered the very human side of her. I remember attending a memorial service once for a very young dancer who tragically fell from a balcony and died. And at the memorial service, another young dancer spoke about him. And I remember for some reason I heard her say, do you know, this is one of the most moving moments because this reminds me that during my time as a director, I was never able to be as close to my dancers as I might have liked to be. And it's only now that I'm no longer directing the company that I can sit and listen to these dancers. And she used to sit in the canteen and talk to people. I remember watching Wayne Sleep sitting at a table with her and the two of them roaring with laughter and then heads down and chatting and thinking, that's amazing. How does that happen? And this was, of course, after she'd ceased to be director. And then I discovered all of that myself. I used to drive her home. I've often said this, how I didn't crash. I mean, negotiating Hyde Park Corner when she just asked you a particularly searching question and you were struggling to find an answer so as not to appear stupid. And negotiating the traffic lights on the various lanes. But she had a wonderful sense of humour. And I'm sure that must have stood her in such good stead through all her troubled times. Because, my goodness, she fought tooth and nail for this company to survive when times were really getting tough. And she must have been there behind Frederick Ashton every step of the way, really. I mean, I'm sure he felt her sitting on his shoulder all the time. And then, of course, she was a huge supporter of Kenneth Macmillan. She absolutely backed him all the way. He always knew he had her on side, even if sometimes she would say very direct and perhaps critical things to him. It was always constructive and positive. And I'm very grateful for those journeys because sometimes I used to go in to her flat and we'd sit and talk. And I just wish I'd written down more of our conversations. But somehow there was never time, you know. And I always thought, I'll remember everything. But, of course, I don't. I remember snippets.
You were, as everybody else was, aware of hierarchies in the company when you joined, that Madame Ninette de Valois would give all the best roles to Margot, and Margot was going to go on forever, and you and Blyn Seymour and the others would have to make do with the less heartthrob roles, no Giselle, no Aurora, no Cinderella. Is that how it felt?
Yes, but, you know, in the beginning, when I first saw Margot, well, Margot for me was the best. So, of course, she was always first. Svetlana Beryosova was very beautiful, and Nadia Narina was vivacious and highly energetic and charming. But Svetlana and Nadia were number two. That clearly was how it was, and one didn't question it. I think it was only later on, when dancers spoke more about their feelings, after de Valois had retired and well into Fred's era, really, that people began to say, of course, you know, Margot shouldn't go on too long. And then eventually Margot should stop now. But of course then when Rudolph had arrived, you know, she had this injection of new life given to her. And of course they gave remarkable performances. But I think there were people who spoke in whispers around the place about other people needing to be given a chance. And I think it was when Frederick Ashton backed Antoinette Sibley and Anthony Dowell, that one saw a new stage of the company developing.
Was she a warm person, did you find?
She was a mysterious person because she was so charming and so warm and real. But, of course, when her husband was shot and when she struggled through that very difficult time when he was in Stoke Mandeville and she was giving performances and driving backwards, she learned to drive for the first time in her life. I mean, one saw that she was made of steel. And some days she would look so exhausted. But, you know, she was such a role model because she never left class early. She never failed to rehearse. She never, ever failed to perform. And I think one's admiration for her was just, you know, off the Richter scale, frankly.
Do you remember when Rodolphe Nureyev came?
Oh, yes, very clearly. I remember the very first day he was in class. There was the story, quickly went around the building. There's a young man come over from France who's in class, and there's some mystery about him. And we looked through the door, we took turns to peep through the glass panel, and there was this very striking, beautiful young man. And of course, we didn't know at the time that he was Russian. We knew nothing about him. And then it was arranged that he would dance with Margot. And some of us younger soloists were invited to be part of that programme. And it was then that we discovered who he was. And he had a huge impact on my life, on my career. Huge.
Huh?
He was invited to mount the second act of La Bayadère. And he chose me as one of the soloists. He was remarkable because he was still in his early 20s, 24, 25 at this time, and he was such a gifted teacher as well as being this remarkable dancer. He had the most amazing patience. If you would work for him, he would just go on hour after hour with you. He never for a moment in all the time I knew him ever made out that anything in Russia was better than the Royal Ballet. He always said, my teacher taught me this, and I think this could help you. I've seen somebody do this way. Try this. And what I think was wonderful about his production of this white act of La Bayadère was that he made it for the Royal Ballet. And he didn't try to turn us into Russian dancers. He could see the qualities of the company at that time. He, of course, absolutely revered de Valois. And he could see the huge talent, the genius of Ashton, and the lyricism and the musicality and the use of the upper body, all the qualities that Fred so loved in dancers, and we all worked so hard to do for him. And Rudolph took all of that and built on that. He used that. But then he also gave us so much of what he'd learnt, of course, in the Mariinsky. And it was that combination, making those two worlds meet in order to make a kind of bigger globe somehow, was extraordinary. And from that moment on, he was one of the most important people in my life as a dancer. I eventually, of course, danced Swan Lake with him, many performances of Swan Lake, and particularly in America. And I also eventually danced the second act of La Bayadère with him, which was an enormous thrill. And dancing with him was unquestionably one of the most exciting things that could happen to you because his adrenaline was so palpable. He sweated it out of his body and it sort of landed on you, you know, and he took you to the edge of the cliff. You were about to fall off at any moment. And so he pushed you. He made you dare in a way that no one else I've ever known or danced with made me feel. I mean, I danced with many wonderful partners, but Rudolph was extraordinary. And of course, in time, he became, I think, a much more difficult person to control for the company because he was a law unto himself and he became such a superstar. And so we were swept along with this amazing young man.
With Kenneth Macmillan, you had a really deep personal affinity. Was it a wordless affinity? Was it just that you understood each other?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't quite know what it was with Kenneth. Of course, I first met him when I was 16, and then I was cast in his ballets. Whenever he made a ballet or if he brought a ballet back, I was always in the cast. And he was only 12 years older than me, so he never felt like Fred did or Ninette. He was almost one of us. And I suppose there are some times in life when you almost don't question. I think it's probably, well, I'm only speaking personally, if something's really good, I don't look at it too carefully in case it goes wrong. And I think my relationship with Kenneth started so wonderfully with The Rite of Spring. And he always made me feel that he just loved it the way I did it. Of course, he would make corrections and make suggestions and say things. But I always felt it gave him so much pleasure. I didn't dare go further than that. I didn't ask what was the reason for this or how did it last. I mean, how I came to assist him was extraordinary. I was coming to the end of my dancing career. I knew I had to hang my shoes up. And I was invited by a friend of a friend to do an audition for the BBC as a possible presenter for a new arts programme. And I found myself sitting in a studio one Monday night, and I was going to read a cue card, and I knew I was on screen because it was television, and it was all so alien. I hadn't got any nerves at all. I was just going to do this and see what happened. And, of course, at the end of it, I thought that was a complete dead loss. And the very next day, I was in the canteen with a cup of tea. Kenneth came in with his cup of tea, and he sat down and he said, he often called me Miss Mason, and he said, "Well, Miss Mason, so what have you been up to recently?" So I said, "Well, actually, last night I was, blah, blah," told him the story. And he said, "You're not thinking of leaving, are you?" And I said, "Well, Kenneth, you know, I have to. I mean, the clock's ticking, and I can't do what I once could do, and..." "Oh," he said, "I shall have to think about this." And the next day I saw him in the corridor, and he said to me, "I was thinking overnight about what you'd said yesterday. You know, I need an assistant because I'm going to be travelling to America a lot as I've become a consultant to American Ballet Theatre. And how would you like to become my assistant?" And that was how it happened. So thank you, BBC, for offering me an audition that flopped. Well, the programme, I think, never got off the ground. But, you know, that was amazing. Because I remember saying, "Yes, please, yes." And he said, no, you must think about this." And I said, "But what's to think about?"
And the darker side of him that you've mentioned, the side that turned to drink, the side that turned to self-doubt. Mm. How did you handle that?
I suppose by the time that I was working with him, he'd really become the preeminent choreographer for the Royal Ballet. Because I only started to work for him in the 80s, really, around about 1980. Sitting with him when he was making Gloria, for instance, that wonderful ballet, and being aware that he was stuck for a moment. But of course, Kenneth was such a pro. You know, he never, ever walked out of a rehearsal. He never dismissed people early. But I remember him turning to me after an hour and a half one day and saying, "What do you think of what I've just done this afternoon?" And being amazed that my opinion was sought for a start. I was so busy making notes and trying to sort of sort out how the patterns were working and everything. And I said, "Well, it looks fine to me. I mean, you know, you haven't explained what you were going to do or how you were going to start, and it seems fine." He said, "I've wasted everybody's time. What I've just done is complete rubbish, and I'm going home now to think about what I'm going to do tomorrow when I come back." And the next day he came in and he said to everybody, "I'm really sorry. I don't want any of you to remember anything of what I did yesterday. It was absolutely useless. It was rubbish. I'm starting from the top again." So I guess those were some dark moments. And I remember much later on when he was creating Prince of the Pagodas, when he'd been seriously ill, and we were very worried, really, how he would get through making a full-length ballet. There were moments then when I was conscious of him having very little energy. But to be honest with you, I don't ever think that I felt in rehearsal he ever let people know that he was struggling.
You were there when he had his first heart attack in Australia.
Mm.
Were you there in the Opera House the night he died?
Yes.
October 29, 1992?
Yes, I saw him lying on the ground. Mm. I think he was the first person I'd ever seen dead. And I think we just wondered, and it was as if our world fell apart that night. I couldn't imagine how it could go forward. Because...